Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, how you doing? And welcome to the show. And we are back with a brand new edition this week featuring Dr. Frank Farley talking about the aftermath of the Casey Anthony case and what may happen if she decides to write a book or do television talk shows. We also chat with producer Rod Pyle about the end of the space shuttle program and where space exploration is going next. We've also got great tips on how to plan the perfect staycation this summer. We've got lots to do. Let's go.
Capture your need for sound.
A horrible crime story that has gripped our attention for several years has been the murder of sweet 2-year-old Kaylee Anthony. The fascination with this case was enormous as new details constantly emerged as to what may or may not have gone on with her mother Casey and her grandparents Cindy and George. The case has now come to a close with Casey being acquitted of the murder of her baby girl, but a lot of questions remain, especially because Casey has vanished from public view and we don't know where she will pop up next. To help us navigate through these facts is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Dr. Farley, thank you so much for joining us again on the Kelly Alexander Show.
You're welcome, Kelly.
First of all, Dr. Farley, what is your take on the outcome of this case? Because no one has been tagged as responsible for Kaylee's murder, and for many of us, justice was not served.
Long before the jury came in with their conclusion, I had concluded there was not enough evidence on either side to do anything but acquit. There were, beyond a reasonable doubt is the key criterion, and it wasn't met. And so they really had to acquit. It was the evidence was a mess. It was just all over the place. The experts were dueling with each other. The prosecution experts would cancel out what the defense experts had said, and vice versa. And there was no compelling, clear evidence as to what happened. And given that, the gallows were in the background, the jury did what had to be done. And if I'd been on the jury, I would have done the same thing. The jury foreman was interviewed, and he said essentially the same thing. He said it was just speculation. He said that's the word that they kicked around in the jury room, that everything seemed to be speculation. And so they had to do the constitutional thing, which is the presumption of innocence, and they did that.
What do you think of how the defense tried to implicate Kaylee's grandparents in her murder?
Well, I thought that was sort of a low blow in many respects. I was very impressed with Jose Baez. I thought he was the most effective lawyer in the room. But I think on that point, it was a real stretch. You can understand that because he is, after all, attempting to save the life of his client. And so he pulled out all the stops. But I thought that went very kind of far. However, the jury foreman said that one of the things they discussed in the jury room was the father. And they felt that there just was an awful lot of suspicions floating around George Anthony. They didn't go anywhere with it, but he said that the jury, just about all of them, felt there's some suspicious behavior going on there. So in a sense, Jose Baez, the lead defense attorney, might have been onto something, but he didn't have convincing evidence, and it sounded sort of like a red herring to get attention off of his client and make these allegations against someone else. Again, it's understandable. This is a capital case, a death penalty case, and he was pulling out all the stops.
Some of these, facts that came up, or not facts, just, throwing mud at the wall was, again, back to George Anthony, the whole sexual abuse claims and all that sort of stuff. And then, Kaylee being in the pool and all this. Did that throw the jury off, you feel, or were they able to wade through that sort of stuff?
The jury foreman himself has spoken. He said it didn't have a lot of impact on them. That he said, for example, on the sex abuse case, they barely discussed it. He said they felt there was nothing there, no evidence. And so in their final 2 days, actually less than 2 days of deliberation, which was the key time for them, he said it didn't really come up, the sexual abuse thing. They had already put that away as unsupported. They were trying to look at everything else. How did she die? And they came to the conclusion that they don't know how she died. And was it an accident, or, you know, was it murder, etc.? And so the ambiguity for them was just way high, and they did what they did.
When you look at all the facts and evidence provided for the case, do you think that the jury had any hope of convicting Casey, or I guess in the grand scheme, as it worked out, everything was just too convoluted?
That's a great word, Kelly. Convoluted is a key word. No, I thought that it was inevitable what they did. And in fact, I'd stated that to the media at some point, that long before their deliberation, that this case just couldn't go anywhere. It was a mess. And, you know, maybe sometime down the road, more evidence will emerge. But, you know, I don't think people should hold their breath. Sometimes in human nature and in human behavior, things happen that we cannot explain, you know, that we cannot find the cause of certain kinds of things. And it often happens in human behavior. And sometimes we simply have to walk away.
Joining us on the program is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. After the trial, Casey was, you know, whisked away by her defense team to an unknown location for her safety. Do you think she's really in danger? And if so, will it be this way for years to come? Will she have to stay in hiding and potentially have to change her name?
Well, I think she might be in danger now, perhaps. I don't think it'll go on forever. She might have to change her name, change her appearance. Those are not too complicated to accomplish. I don't think that she will, and I think as the case fades away, you know, the anger will subside. It always does, and new crimes and new courtroom dramas come on the scene, and they will grip the country. So I feel that there's a possibility of a normal life for her in the long run. But I think that in the short term, she probably has to sort of lay low. And she's got an attorney, Jose Baez, who has been a master in this trial. And he probably has ideas as to how to, you know, get her into deep cover for a period of time. There's all this talk about them writing a book. And my guess is there are offers that have come in. And so I think that she can ultimately assume some degree of a normal life, but it's going to take quite a while because of the level of anger. And it's actually very upsetting to someone like me, who is a, you know, a culture watcher, that society has been so infuriated with her and with the jury even. I mean, the criminal justice system in this country, in the U.S., has been followed, and it has found her not guilty by beyond a reasonable doubt. People really need to move on. I mean, that's the system. And my feeling is that if they don't like that system, they can move to many other countries in the world that don't have anything like a system of justice. And, you know, I would suggest Cuba is only 90 miles away.
Right.
And so it's time to say the system worked. She might have gotten away with something, but we really don't know. There simply isn't the evidence there. And so, you know, let's let the anger subside. It's not that healthy for people anyway to be so worked up over this, and psychologically, in my view, and move on.
And actually, with regards to the anger, you know, being placed at the jury, obviously you feel that that's a misplaced anger because they were following what they needed to do by the letter of the law.
Yes, absolutely. And it's disgraceful. These are simply ordinary folk who are impounded on this jury. They did their job, and now some of them feel apparently that they themselves need some kind of deep cover because of all the public anger. and they were simply citizens doing their time-honored job on a jury. And they had a lot more of the facts than most people. And, you know, television has all of the lawyer pundits on TV, you know, have skewered this case in many respects. Many of them tilted in favor of the prosecution from day one. And that's not right. You know, again, the U.S. Constitution has the presumption of innocence. And I say, if you don't like it, then you don't want to live in a country that's got that as in our governing documents. And so the jury, you know, we're getting the facts day to day to day in the room, in the courtroom. But the people outside society was getting it sort of tilted by TV and by other media. And so they often got, you know, a bias simply from the media about this case. For example, Nancy Grace has, you know, become enormously famous over this. And she was screaming guilty, guilty, guilty from day one. And you're innocent until proven guilty. You're not guilty until proven innocent. And that is so fundamental. None of us would like to live in a culture that has guilty until proven innocent. And so I was very unhappy with some of the media coverage. Some of it was okay, but so many lawyers seemed to be tilting to the guilty verdict long before this trial was ever over. And the jury, however, was not seeing any of that media, and they came to a different conclusion, and I think we should go with it.
Regarding, I guess, you know, media coverage in general, the fact that I think book companies and movie companies are now salivating at the idea of getting a hold of her and having her agree to tell her side of the story. Do you think that will work? Do you think she will accept that? Do you think people will want to hear her side?
She probably would accept it. I think that her expenses are going to be pretty huge, and there are intimations of lawsuits coming. So she'll probably need money, so she'll probably say yes if such a thing happens. And I don't know how many people would watch it. I think there's a natural curiosity that will remain for some time. For example, in a book, you know, I think most of us feel that there's something wrong, you know, with this situation, and that maybe she did something, but we don't know what it was. Was it an accident that went bad, as the defense attorney took that particular position? And it could have some merit. Well, she clearly lies a lot. So if she were to write a book, one thing about liars is they lie so much, and they compound one lie on top of another lie on top of another lie. They sort of lose track of what they've said. And maybe in a book that she would write, she will reveal important things. That is, she's just lied so much, and she will not know what she had said way back and what lies she'd made. And maybe something will be revealed in this book that will be of great interest to people concerned about this case. If her lawyers join in with her in a book, I think it would be fascinating. I would like to see Jose Baez and Cheney Mason's angle. Those are her two lead attorneys. I would like to see their angle on this whole case in print, where they can lay it all out. And so I think for a culture watcher and a crime watcher, this would be of interest. A survey, a non-scientific survey, was done as to how many people would buy a book by her, and only about 17% in that non-scientific survey said they would buy a book by Casey Anthony. Of course, 17% of potentially millions of people is a lot of books, so it would probably sell pretty well. And a movie, I don't know who would go to the movie, but crime is of enormous fascination to people, the dark side, and I think a movie would probably be successful.
Do you think that Casey Anthony will end up in the near future on TV talk shows, and is that a good idea?
I think she will end up on TV talk shows. I don't have a problem with that. She has not been convicted of anything. And again, it might help people who feel she is guilty. Maybe a good interviewer might be able to get some information out of her. Remember, one of the things is she never took the stand in this trial. So her personal take on everything was never heard directly in the courtroom. And maybe a very clever interviewer might be able to get some stuff out of her that would be helpful for all of those people who have been watching this trial and still are concerned about it and want to know more. And so therefore, it could provide more information, you know, some clever interviewers, maybe like Kelly Alexander, could get something out of this person.
Okay. And do you think Casey Anthony will ever be seen as a victim by the public?
I doubt by the majority of the public, but I think already she's seen as a victim by some, yes. And some people feel that she was never directly connected. She showed some bad behavior, of course, but did she murder her daughter? I mean, in the waning minutes of the trial, in the final summation, etc., by the prosecutor, he outlined the motive as they saw it, and it was absurd. I mean, the only motive that the prosecution could seem to come up with was that, you know, Casey Anthony wakes up one day and says, I want to have more fun, so I've got to kill my daughter. That was it. That was the main part of the motive. That is, she wanted more fun, so she had to kill her daughter, and then she could go party. I've studied human motivation for decades. That would be probably the last motive I would ever think of. And I think the jury probably saw it that way also. It was just, you know, nonsense.
And Dr. Farley, if you were on her defense team, how best do you reintegrate Casey into society? Because, you know, a lot of people have no use for her. Will she ever be able to hold and keep a job?
Yes, she will be. Again, there are people who will, you know, who agree with the jury verdict. And they may have suspicions that something happened, an accident. There's an old formula, goes something like this. An accident happens, it's followed by guilt feelings, because maybe you were negligent. And in this case, if you believe the swimming pool accident, maybe you should have been there and you weren't. You were in some other part of the house or something and she drowned. So accident followed by guilt, followed by cover-up. Because maybe you could be charged with some kind of negligence or something for this accident. And so there's nothing new about that. You know, the accident followed by guilt, followed by cover-up. Nothing new in human history about that. So some people might buy into that with her in her case. And, of course, the father, too. I mean, they're, you know, as the jury foreman said, there's suspicions about the father. So he apparently was the last person to see Kaylee alive. On what, June the 16th, as I recall. Well, what has been his role at all, if any? And so some people are going to say, look, there's doubt all over the place, and she's sort of rehabilitated herself. She's been maybe getting some college credits or something, and I would hire her. So I think that she's hireable by some people and some jobs.
And in your I guess, you know, a professional opinion as a psychologist, if you were again surrounding Casey Anthony right now, what sort of help do you think she needs to move forward?
I hope that she sees a psychologist for a while, because, gosh, it could be argued that she's been through this trauma, and some people can take that sort of thing well and others can't. And so it's probably a good idea for her in her process of reentry. Remember, she was in prison without trial for 3 years almost. And that's difficult to take. You know, you're sitting in prison for 3 years and you still haven't come to trial. And, you know, how is she handling that, you know, in her head? And so I would certainly hope that she sees a psychologist for a while just to help her reenter the world, as it were, and go forward from there. My own sort of gut sense, and I'm speculating totally, but my sense is that she may be fairly resilient. But again, I don't have any evidence for that. But she sort of, in the courtroom itself, handled a lot of horrendous things fairly calmly. And if Jose Baez, her attorney, and Chaney Mason, if they stay in touch with her, which I assume they will, and work with her, she'll be getting a lot of what, in my opinion, is probably pretty sound advice. And so that plus maybe a psychologist along the way, I think that she might end up with a kind of normal life.
And in your opinion, do you think, because again, it's been, you know, talked about and bandied about in the media and stuff about her relationship with her parents, do you think they will ever come together again, the three of them? Because I don't even think they've apparently talked in a couple of years.
Very difficult. You know, it's, again, hard to predict, but all of the public information and suggests that they are pretty alienated. Those things can be reversed and remediated. So, but my own guess would be that if it were to happen, it might be more with the mother. But, you know, some horrendous things were said in that courtroom about her parents. And so I would say this is a family with deep, deep issues. And I'm not certain that it's possible to bring them back. But again, you know, human nature being what it is, we're resilient. We often reinvent our lives. And, you know, a good psychologist, what we would call a family psychologist, could possibly work with them and get some traction, and maybe things could get a little bit better.
And I just wanted to ask your opinion as well on the mother, because she seems to be an interesting figure in all of this, where you're not quite sure, I guess, where her allegiance, if you want to use that word, lies. What are your thoughts on her, and do you think she knew more than what she said?
Gosh, I don't know. There was the whole issue of the search for chloroform, and now that's sort of up in the air. I mean, it was hinted at in the trial that that whole thing was, in a sense, false. The famous 84 searches on the computer for chloroform. And now this Canadian programmer is apparently saying, no, there's only, I mean, it was using his program, I guess. There was only one search for chloroform. And, you know, that illustrates what may happen with this trial. There was so much ambiguity and so much uncertainty that this thing can just keep going for years as different opinions occur, maybe a little bit of information, a little bit of evidence here or there, and this there'll be revisions of this trial for years. But in her case, the mother's case, I don't know. I don't know if she was lying. It's almost impossible to detect lying under those conditions. Somebody's in the witness stand. Some people think they can detect that just by looking at them, but very few people can. And so I don't know if she was lying. She has attempted, apparently, to make contact with Casey. So it suggests that there's some movement, at least from her point of view, to reconnect. But her role, I don't know. It, again, is interesting that the jury foreman didn't, I think, as I recall, even mention her in the interview that he has given. He mentioned the father.
Okay.
And that the jury did have suspicions about the father, but I don't think the mother really came into their radar particularly.
And I guess in the end, to wrap sort of it all up, what do you say to the public who, you know, have just been so sickened by this case and its outcome? Are we supposed to just, you know, let it go and move forward? Because I think a lot of people just got so wrapped up, especially with the media just, you know, constantly replaying Kaylee's photo.
Well, yes, the playing of the photo. But, you know, there were other things the media constantly played, which were scenes of how what a happy relationship Kaylee had with her mother, Casey. And and it's interesting that so many loving photographs were taken by the family. That's also, I think, an important point. Well, the case is over, can't be retried, not for murder. And, you know, if people want to continue to winnow and sift the evidence and talk about it and kvetch over it, you know, that's fine. But I don't think one should sustain the anger too long, because on expressed anger or unrealized anger, I mean, there's nothing you can do about it, is not particularly healthy. And so I think that for the nation and for individuals in the nation, it's getting close to the time when we should say adieu, that we don't know what went on for sure. And, you know, stay tuned, because something may develop. But I don't think it's healthy to continue to fight the battle of the Casey Anthony trial.
Okay. Dr. Farley, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia.
She was just a baby, barely 2 years old. A story that shouldn't have to be told. See, that little girl with big brown eyes stole our hearts and touched our lives. Now we cry, 'cause we can't understand. You see, she wanted to learn to play guitar, be a ballerina, a movie star. She could have gone so far. Now she can be anything that she wants to. She can ride her bike every afternoon. And she can laugh and play with her dolls and games, just like all little girls should get to do. Young for a life to be taken, she's going places. I bet she'll spend her time skipping rope, drawing rainbows on the streets that are paved with gold. And she'll ride a big wheel, jumping curves in the parking lot of a great big church. And I wish I could see it all, but a mammy will live on right here till I get over there and see her again. She can be anything that she wants to. She can ride her bike every afternoon. She can laugh and play in those backyard games, just like all little girls should get to do. Too young for life to be taken, she's going places. Swim and seesaw, just like all little girls should get to do. We will sing sweet Kaylee's praises. She's safe in the arms of God's good graces. Yeah, she's going places.
American Space Shuttle program has come to a close, and with it comes the end of an era. To help us understand what happens next with space exploration is Rod Pyle. He's a writer, producer, and director, and notably wrote and produced Modern Marvels, Apollo 11 for the History Channel. Rod, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me back.
Rod, so, you know, it's been an emotional couple of weeks, or I guess even months, you know, for both people who are directly involved in the space shuttle program, and then for regular citizens like us, you know, who have been admirers of space travel for a long time. And so now that the program, I guess, is quote unquote officially over, what is your sense of things of how people are really feeling that the shuttle is, I guess, obsolete?
I think people that are directly involved with the program, of course, feel very sad. I spent a lot of time at Johnson Space Center last year, and those feelings were palpable, and you could really tell that people were feeling very let down by the cancellation of Constellation and then the end of the shuttle. I think for years we've been operating in this idea that, well, the shuttle may be ending, but we've got a bright future ahead with the return to the moon with Constellation. About $7 or $8 billion is spent on that program, and now it's been canceled, and there are some good reasons that it was canceled. But it still leaves us with no follow-on. So I think there's a real profound sense of what now? Beyond that, there's a few people that have their noses a little out of joint about having to hire the Russians to take us back and forth to the space station, but that's just the position we've put ourselves in.
And now that Atlantis has sort of touched down and, you know, no more shuttle missions are going to happen, what happens with NASA now and its partnering countries? Because I think a lot of us are very confused. Like, I know, like, I was, you know, doing research on the internet trying to figure out exactly what's going on, and I really have no clue.
So the shuttle had some issues. It was obsolete when it was introduced. It had been cut to the bone by the Nixon administration and wasn't the shuttle they had originally wanted. And in the midst of trying to find a mission for the shuttle, we, of course, came up with the space station, which is where most of the international partnering came into play and will continue to come into play with us hitching rides with the Russian Soyuz spacecraft to get up there and back. You know, our international partners have come and gone over the years, but a lot of them really counted on the shuttle because that was the only heavy lift capability we had of getting back and forth. Now that we don't have that, we will still have access to space station. We do still have an international involvement up there. We do still have a mission in orbit. But I think the real question is, what comes after that? Now, the station was scheduled to be deorbited and decommissioned in 2015 at one point. Now it's been extended through at least 2020. So NASA does still have a mission, and that doesn't include the unmanned missions, of course. But I think the question you're asking really is, you know, what's the next big step? What's that inspiring Kennedy moment that we're all looking for? And that's the questions everybody is asking. Now, the party line coming from NASA directly is near-Earth objects and a heavy lift booster. So we're going to continue to work on a capsule for the crew. We're going to continue to work on a large booster that will be somewhere between the shuttle and the Saturn V in terms of getting heavy things up in orbit. And we're going to aim in very broad terms towards near-Earth objects, meaning asteroids, but that has a certain lack of sex appeal. So there is this question of really what is the next profound mission, and there isn't an answer.
Wow. Like, I kept thinking that there was like a plan, and now it just feels like there's no plan. And I guess that leads me to my next question is, you know, do most people that have been working with the space shuttle program, you know, we're hearing that a bunch of them obviously are losing their jobs. Where do they go from here?
Well, it's interesting. You know, NASA, if you work for NASA directly, you're a civil servant, and it's very difficult to lose your job, although some people will get furloughed. Most of the people losing their job are contractors. There's between, depending on how you count who a shuttle worker is, there's between 8 and 14,000 people losing their jobs right away. But then, of course, there's all that support infrastructure around that, the smaller subcontractors, the restaurants, all the people that depend around Kennedy Space Center and Johnson Space Center and the Marshall Space Center on the shuttle program or some derivative of it for their livelihood. So there's a lot more of those people that are going to be out of work than initially shows up. In terms of the engineers and the flight controllers and the technicians and so forth, you know, hopefully they'll be absorbed into the general aerospace infrastructure, and some of them will go work in this private industry that's been so hyped by NASA and in their new space budget. But obviously a lot of them are going to be out of work, and there's going to be a lot of people looking for a new mission in life. One of the things that does come up when you talk about NASA's new orientation and the new budget is that a lot of the money that they are getting is being put into the private space sector. Now, it's always been the case, in a sense, because they always hired contractors to build the hardware. You know, Rockwell built the shuttle and so forth. So now you've got SpaceX and Blue Origin and some of these other companies building the new follow-on private spacecraft. But what they're basically getting is seed money from NASA to develop these things, and then they'll get hired to actually fly as private contractors. So hopefully some of the people will be absorbed by those companies, but there's going to be a lot of them out of work.
And what's going to happen to Kennedy Space Center in Florida and Johnson Space Center in Houston? Like, are they going to be shut down and become ghost towns? Because I'm really, like, I'm very confused by all of this.
No, they're both going to keep operating. Kennedy in Florida launches everything that doesn't go out of Vandenberg on the West Coast, which isn't very much. So Kennedy has the Kennedy Space Center proper, which is manned spaceflight operations and so forth. That'll be mothballed for a while. But they're already converting one of the shuttle launch pads for the heavy lift booster and other rockets to fly out of there. So that work is ongoing as we speak. Then just down the island from there is the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, and that's where all the Delta and the Titan launches go out of for unmanned flights of satellites and so forth. So they have work to do. They have a big tourist operation there, and that sounds kind of silly to put that in the same conversation that we're having. but it's a little bit like Universal Studios. You know, they make a lot of money off of their movies, but they make a ton of money off of their theme park operations. And interestingly, some place like Kennedy Space Center makes a profound amount of money off of their tourist operations there. So, you know, it kind of becomes this combination of second-level spaceflight operations and a tourist attraction. Johnson, less so. They have a small tourist operation there. But that is still the control center for the space station. Some of the unmanned flights will be operating some of their science out of there. And there's a lot of research and development that happens there. So they're not going away. They're just downsizing. But that's painful enough.
Joining us on the show right now is writer, producer, and director Rod Pyle, who produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel. Rod, we talked a little bit earlier about where, I guess, some of the people that worked on the space shuttle program are going to go. But with regards to, I guess, specifically the engineers and scientists who, you know, work with NASA, are they going to continue to move forward, like, in other forms of space exploration? Because I know we talked about the asteroid thing. Like, is there talk of them going back to the moon? Like, it just seems like everything's sort of willy-nilly right now.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about going back to the moon, and George Bush famously in 2004 announced that program, but the funding never materialized. So it was one of those things, a little bit like President Reagan when he was talking about space station freedom decades ago. The idea was nice, but the money didn't follow. And in this case, the idea was nice, but the money for Constellation Project back to the moon didn't follow. So there was a lot of people working on that up until it got canceled last year. Interestingly, you know, there's been $7 or $8 billion spent to develop Constellation. It's going to cost another couple billion to wrap it up because you have to pay the contractors to put everything away and finish up what they were hired to do. But you can't actually cancel it until you get your funding bill, and the appropriation hasn't been put through yet. So that's sitting in limbo, which is part of what you're talking about, I think. In terms of the actual engineers and the scientists, you know, a lot of these people work at universities, so they've got other jobs already, fortunately. But for the people who are actually on the NASA payroll, if they're a civil servant, they'll get reassigned to something else. If they're a contractor or somebody who was brought in under a different kind of program, not directly working for the government, they'll be let go and they're going to have to find something else to do.
In the grand scheme of things, I guess if I feel that there is no one answer to this, but can you tell us why the shuttle program had to come to an end? Was it strictly a money thing, or was it also the technology? Like, you know, everyone's saying the shuttle was just obsolete now.
There's a couple of answers to that question. It's a really excellent question. Like I said, it was obsolete for a long time in one sense, in terms of that technology was baseline in the 70s and it was aging, and they upgraded things incrementally, but you can only do so much. There's a basic airframe and a basic aerodynamic design that you're stuck with. So if they were to design a shuttle today, and there are a couple of private companies designing smaller orbiters that are not too dissimilar from the shuttle, but they have evolved the design quite a bit, and it'll be a different kind of a space plane. But in terms of obsolescence, the main thing, and the reason I think that the program was shut down, there's two things. One, by the time we had done the last shuttle flight, STS-135, the last of the really heavy elements that needed to go to the space station had been delivered, so we didn't have that heavy lift need that we've had for years. And the other one is just that the shuttle is very expensive to fly. If you amortize the flights over the length of the program versus the cost, it was about $1.4 to $1.5 billion a flight. That's really expensive access. So, and there's a few ways to slice those numbers, but that's the gross answer. You know, if you take it 135 flights divided by how much it cost, it was about $1.5 billion a shot. So Soyuz is a lot cheaper. It's about $60 million a seat per astronaut or cosmonaut that goes up. And hopefully the private contractors that are working on rockets in the U.S. now that are being funded by NASA to some extent and will be having contracts with NASA to service the space station and beyond will be able to do much better than that. They're looking to reduce cost by an order of 5 or 10. Interestingly, SpaceX, which is owned by Elon Musk of PayPal fame, has announced a few months ago that they're going to build their own heavy lift booster, which is going to be about half the lifting capacity of the old Saturn V rocket. They're going to do it hopefully with NASA money, but they're determined to go ahead whether they're funded by NASA or not. And that could put us in a whole new ball game. It just depends on whether they're successful in that endeavor. They're looking at 2013 to test that.
And speaking of these private companies, you know, they're supposed to be working on these spacecrafts, you know, to carry people. A question that came to my mind thinking about this is that if there's all these private companies that are doing this, how is this going to be regulated? Or are people just going to blast off whenever the heck they want to?
That's a really great question. And I actually was talking to a guy at Johnson Space Center about that a couple of months ago, because I said, how do you regulate this? And he said, it's very interesting. You know, if they're flying out of the Kennedy Space Center, Cape Canaveral, they're under NASA control until they leave the ground, and the Air Force is involved in that too. But then up through going into orbit, they're basically under the FAA if they have passengers of some kind. And then NASA doesn't pick up control and jurisdiction again until they come within a certain distance of the space station, because now there's a collision potential, obviously. So NASA has to tell them exactly how to approach, you know, what speed and what vectors and so forth. But that in-between area is kind of something gray that they're trying to figure out at this point. It seems to fall under the FAA. And they don't have a lot of experience in spaceflight. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, especially when you talk about these flights starting to take tourists. It's one thing to be an astronaut because you're signing the dotted line saying, yes, I'll risk my life for my country. I want to be on the government payroll and there'll be a space buccaneer. But when you're a tourist and you're going up into either a suborbital flight, like the ones operating under Virgin Galactic, or into an orbital flight, this is a whole new area of risk assessment, and there's insurance concerns, and there's liability concerns, and there's all kinds of stuff that they have to take into account, and they're just starting to work through those problems, and it's going to be a very sticky wicket for a while.
Okay, well, I'm glad I asked you about it, because it just came to me, I'm like, this could be a really bad traffic jam, like, going on up there.
It could be.
Okay. And I have to ask you this, because you mentioned to me earlier that you were at the last launch for Atlantis. Can you tell me what that was like to be there for that shuttle launch, the last one?
The energy was really amazing. There's a lot of people staying, obviously, in the hotels in Orlando waiting for the launch, and we were going up in big bus loads. I was on a Johnson Space Center bus, but there are all kinds of private vendors doing it as well. It took an hour to get up there. It took 5 hours to get back, because there was, I think, upwards of 1 million people in the area watching the launch. We were on the Banana River, which is about, I believe, 5 miles away. It's not too far from the press site. And, you know, when you go to shuttle launches, you're used to waiting 3, 4, 5 days and cycling through these count resets and so forth and tanking and detanking and all that. I don't think any of us thought the thing was going to get off the first day, because they just don't tend to. But it did, which is a good thing, because they had pink-slipped people for within a week or two of the shuttle returning, so they really needed to be on schedule if they could. But it took off within a few minutes of its appointed time. It was spectacular. It was a little overcast, so you only saw it for about 10 or 12 seconds as it cleared the pad. But when you do have clouds like that, you get a lot more sound coming off the shuttle, because it reflects off the bottom of the clouds, so it's very loud. It's very impressive. There are a lot of tears, a lot of clapping, a lot of yelling, a lot of cheering. And then once it was gone and the sound had begun to fade away, people got a very maudlin look on their faces. They were smiling, but there was a sadness there too. And it was very quiet as folks filed back onto the buses, because I don't think any of us really knew how to feel.
Speaking to you, Rod, who obviously has such admiration for space travel, are you, I don't want to use the word, but like, scared of what's going to happen next? Like, are you trepidatious? Like, do you worry that things aren't going to work out well for wherever we're headed?
I do worry a little bit. You know, you're talking to somebody who's 54 years old. So I grew up during the Apollo years. And as far as I was concerned, we were going to go to the moon, and then we were going to go to Mars with that same hardware that had been adapted a little bit. And we were going to have space stations and all kinds of things going on. And only a very small percentage of that has come to fruition. So over the years, like I think most people in my generation, I've become cautious about trusting what I hear. So am I disappointed? Yes. Do I think it's a disaster? No. I think it's a new direction. I think it's a very risky direction on a certain level, because there's a chance that the whole thing will just fade away. You know, NASA isn't the best at doing their own PR. They don't blow their own trumpet very well, and indeed they're not funded or chartered to do that. That's not really part of their job. So it's up to people like me to try and do that, and we have limited budgets and time to do so. But I think there is a certain risk it'll sort of fall off the public radar. But with the elimination of the shuttle, as sad as that is for a lot of people, that does free up a lot of money for other things. And I do have hope that the private sector will step in. It would really be helpful if we found aliens on Mars, or if we found large nuggets of gold and platinum sitting all over the moon. So that there was an immediate interest and a self-interest to get up there and do things. That's not going to happen. So it's got to be about science more than about enterprise. But I do think that there's hope, and I haven't given up dreaming that we're going to be on Mars somewhere before 2030. There is one more component, of course, which is international competition. In the 60s, we had the Russians as the big bad guys that we're having this toe-to-toe technological smackdown with. We don't have the Russians in that sense anymore. They're partners now, but we do have the Chinese. And that system of government doesn't have to ask for money the same way the American political system does. And they're going. They're building a space station. They've orbited three times already, and they have plans to be on the moon by 2020. And I think the afternoon or morning that they wander over to the Apollo 11 launch site and start picking over what we left there, there's going to be a lot of politicians in Washington looking at each other saying, how could you let this happen? And, of course, the answer is going to have to be from us, the people. How did all of you let this happen? And it was a lack of interest.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, Rod, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
That's Rod Pyle, writer, producer, and director, and he notably wrote and produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
With the high price of gas and exorbitant airline fares, millions of people are staying home this summer and skipping an exotic or expensive family vacation. But just because you may need to stay close to home for financial reasons doesn't mean you can't make the most of your time off. To give us some good ideas and a fresh perspective on how to make the most of your own neck of the woods is Sarah Welsh. She's the co-founder of GetButtonedUp.com and co-author of Pretty Neat, The Buttoned-Up Way to Get Organized and Let Go of Perfection. Sarah, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Sarah, is it really possible to take a relaxing break from the daily grind without leaving your home, neighborhood, city?
Absolutely, yes. The trick, and this is a really important thing to note, is a little bit of organization goes a long, long way. The biggest mistake most people make when they take a vacation or a staycation at home is they don't plan. So then they get to their time off and they're checking emails, doing the grocery shopping, doing the laundry, and it ends up being like any other day. And at the end of their little vacation, they're kind of sad. They feel like, oh, I didn't get a vacation. So you really do have to mentally put yourself in the state that, hey, this is really going to be a vacation and I need to treat it that way and I'm plan for it in the same way that I would a vacation.
And I'm assuming that most families know at least a few weeks, if not a month or more in advance that they're not leaving home for their vacation. And so I guess having this extra time, like you said, it has to be really important to plan what they can do in their own neighborhood.
Absolutely. And you know, I would always advise families, in particular families with young kids, to give your week a theme, whether you have a week or 4 days, give it a theme, because there's something magic that happens when you give your staycation a theme. It could be something as simple as, you know, spa tranquility or beach getaway, or, you know, something like frontier days. It doesn't necessarily matter what the theme is, but once you have an idea that you can then start to brainstorm activities around, it takes on sort of a magical spin. So that's definitely something worth considering. And it's fun to do. I mean, gather everyone around the dinner table or, you know, around the couch at some point this weekend and just kind of throw ideas out there and have everybody vote on their best idea. It gets everybody engaged in how can we make this as much fun as humanly possible.
And how important is it to tailor your staycation like you would a vacation? Meaning, you know, if you're the type of family that when you are away somewhere else that you do, you know, tons of activities, like going to theme parks or whatever, is it important to sort of mimic that behavior here?
It's probably a good idea if that's what sort of triggers your brain to think, okay, I'm on vacation or we're on vacation. But they don't have to be expensive activities. I mean, you can make activities in your own backyard. So, for example, you know, you could have, this is just a little example if you have little kids. There are amazing tutorials out there online for putting together a $2 basically PVC pipe car wash for little kids. You hook up your hose to it, drill some holes in the PVC pipe, and you attach your hose to it, and it looks like a car wash, feels like a car wash, and is good fun for the whole family for an afternoon. You could do something like have a wine tasting party. Have your friends over. Everybody brings you know, two bottles of wine, give the wine tasting party a theme, like great refreshing reds under $10. And everybody brings two bottles of wine. You put one bottle that people bring over to the side and taste test with the other bottle. And the person who brings the winning wine gets to go home with everybody's second bottle of wine. Just sort of a fun twist. But you can have activities and lots of them in your own backyard without having to spend a lot of money.
Joining us on the show is Sarah Wells. She's the co-founder of GetButtonedUp.com and co-author of Pretty Neat, The Buttoned Up Way to Get Organized and Let Go of Perfection. Do things vary if your kids are a bit older, or do you hold them to doing activities like they would if you were on vacation? So I guess I'm meaning, like, you know, I'm sure some teenagers, if they are staying home, would rather maybe spend the days with their friends as opposed to with their family. Do you still make them join in, or maybe do you let them include a friend so that it's not as cheesy for them, I guess, as maybe they're thinking when they're 14, 15, 16?
Yes, when parents are no longer as cool as they once were.
Exactly.
I think that's a fantastic idea. I would say, you know, you do need to treat this as though you were going on vacation. So family time and together time is an important component of that. But absolutely, if you can open it up and have them include their friends or one or two very good friends in some of the activities that you're doing, they're much more likely to be excited about it anyway. You know, I mean, that said, teenagers are going to give you an eye roll or two, but they're often the ones who kind of get into it and end up having the most fun. So definitely include them in it. Don't let them just go off on their own.
Okay. And then I guess if we sort of look at things objectively, what are the main do's and don'ts of staycations?
So number one do is plan. So you're not going to want to go grocery shopping or two or three times during the week. You're not going to want to be doing laundry. So plan those chores so that you're not doing them during your staycation. Number two, give yourself blackout times. So times where you're not going to be checking your iPhones and Blackberries and emails and basically being online, because that is, the more you do it, the less likely you're going to feel like you actually got a break and were on vacation at the end of it. And it can be very tempting when you're at home to just quickly check things here and there. Give yourself, you know, from, you know, 6 to 8 in the morning, I'm allowed to look at email. Otherwise, I'm offline. So that's another very important thing to do. Another great thing to do is go online and look for free events that are going on in your own backyard. You can go look on community websites, government websites. You can also look up websites like localwineevents.com that list free wine tastings, free food engagements that are going on in your own backyard. You just punch in your zip code and look it up. So that's another great thing to do. And then finally, I would say reach out to friends and neighbors. One of the things we all complain about in this digital age where we're going 300 miles an hour is, I don't have enough time to really catch up with the people that I live next to or that I'm really good friends with. Plan reconnecting with friends as a major part of your staycation. It makes it that much more enjoyable.
Okay, fantastic. Sarah, thank you so much for hanging out today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Sarah Welsh, co-author of Pretty Neat, The Buttoned Up Way to Get Organized and Let Go of Perfection. And again, check her out at www.buttonedup.com. Thank you so much for joining us on the show this week. And my thanks as well to my wonderful guests, including Dr. Frank Farley, Rod Pyle, and Sarah Welsh. And by the way, as usual, leaving you with your positive quote of the week, this time from CNN's Anderson Cooper: you do what's in your gut. If you've been doing it long enough, what's in your gut will be appropriate. There you go. If you've got any comments or questions, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Pare, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.